Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of KCBX and its hosts. Today on Central Coast Voices, join host Mario Espinoza Kulik and guest as he discuss Arab American histories on the Central Coast. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation. Join the conversation and call us at 805-781-3875, or you can email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Now let's join Mario and its guests. Over to you, Mario.
Thank you, Hank. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Dr. Mario Espinoza Kulik, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Today, we're talking about Motini, a community-centered oral history and archiving project documenting Arab American life, contributions, and the legacy on California's Central Coast through stories of home and belonging. This project lives online at www.motinislow.org, where listeners can engage with the collection and help surface themes across the stories. The project team also launched a physical exhibit of the Motini Project on January 24th at the Robert E. Kennedy Library on the California Polytechnic State University San Luis Obispo campus, which will be available for public viewing until March 20th. I did want to spell that out for everybody listening. That is M-A-W-T-I-N-I, Motini. Joining me for today's show, we have Dr. Farah Al-Naqib, Associate Professor of History at Cal Poly and Motini Project Participant, Vicky Tamush, Motini Project Participant and Arab American Community Organizer, as well as Iyad Jamali, Motini Project Participant and Ethnic Studies Major at Cal Poly. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I'm so excited you're here, and I want our listeners to have a chance to get to know each of you. And so let's start with you, Dr. Farah. What's your role in Motini? And also, what motivated you to contribute to this or help build this project for our county?
Yeah, great. Thank you for that question. So I am a historian, and in my research, I've used oral history a lot as a historian, you know, filling in gaps in our historical knowledge about the past. But increasingly, I've become more and more interested in looking at how oral history can be used to tell the histories of communities and working with communities in telling those stories. So over the last few years, I've been doing some research. Iyad also has participated in that. I'm sure he'll talk about it. That has sort of interrogated like long-held academic practices of oral history that don't always work well with how we work with communities in that project, in those kinds of projects. And so I was doing a lot of this research, building resources and training materials. I've trained communities in doing oral history. And I was very interested in wanting to put some of these new ideas and methods that were grounded in social justice oral history work into practice. And it was around that time that this grant opportunity, I should mention that Motini was launched with the City of San Luis Obispo DEI High Impact Grant from 2024-25. And myself and the other project leads, Vicky, and our two colleagues, Sandra Saruf and Noha Kulkela, we knew we were interested in doing something that amplified the presence of our Arab American community here in San Luis Obispo. We really wanted their stories heard, particularly, you know, in the given, you know, context in the world that we feel like Arabs are often not real well represented in our perspectives. And so this was the perfect opportunity to put these community-based oral history practices into a community-based project here in San Luis Obispo.
Wonderful. And Vicky, what do you want listeners to know about your journey and how you got involved with Motini?
I think what might be a little bit unique among the three of us here today is that my journey is a little longer because I'm old. And when I began in community activism, it was a very, very different world. And I pulled up here in front of your station today with some inherited dread from previous situations, thinking, well, here it goes. I'm going to be set up. I have to prepare myself for hostile questions and accusations that aren't true and set up callers who are here to create controversy and make a radio program more interesting or exciting, and not because whatever I'm here to talk about is exciting enough on its own. And I sat with that thought for a minute because that's very important to recognize. That's still in me. It's in everyone in my age group. And I think it has filtered down into people's children and even grandchildren. And this sort of project, Multani, helps root that out. There comes a point where you have to use new ways to root hate out of society. And it's difficult to be creative about that. We've tried everything we can think of. This is something new. This is putting a positive emphasis on something that every other group has had a positive emphasis on already. It's been an incredible privilege to be part of this.
Thank you, Vicky. And Iyad, how about your story? Can you please share about yourself to our listeners and how you became involved with this project?
Thank you. Yeah, I would say I got involved in this project because of Dr. Farah Naqib. I've taken classes with her, and I was very interested in her classes because as an Palestinian Arab American myself, I noticed that there hasn't been enough representation of Arab Americans, especially representation of ourselves. Like, we don't ever get to speak for ourselves or about ourselves. There's always an outside source that speaks for us. And this oral history project, before Multani, me and Farah worked on an oral history lab, a Beacon research project at Cal Poly, which focused on rooting oral history in social justice and in social justice to help amplify the voices of those who are underrepresented. And when she proposed Multani to the city and she got approved through the grant, she extended me an offer to be a student assistant, but also an interview of the project. And so I wear many hats, as the leaders of the Multani project say. I'm an interviewer, interviewee, and a student assistant in the project.
That's so cool. And I think for our listeners, Farah, if you could please let them know what goes into oral history? Like, how do you become an oral historian or implement the method of oral history?
That's a really good question. Traditionally, oral history really emerged as a way of challenging or countering top-down narratives that usually excluded many groups, underrepresented groups, whose histories aren't documented in conventional archives. Mm-hmm. So the method really emerged in the 60s, 70s with this history from below kind of approach, but it's moved more and more into outside of just the walls of academia and into the sort of rooted in communities as we're talking about earlier. How do you begin an oral history project is difficult. I mean, I think one of the advantages that we had of our project is we're all from the community that we're working with. We're all sort of insiders in that way. So we knew a lot of members of the community who we reached out to want to be interviewed. Most of our interviewers, not all, but most of our interviewers were also members of the community. So it was really grounded in the community itself. I don't know if you want to get into the technical parts of oral history and how we do that, or
I think that was really clear for me, and I think for our listeners, just to know that it's a way for our for marginalized communities or communities that have been historically underrepresented to have a more of a active role in telling their story and not for it to be told for them. There's one quote that I always I always teach in my classes, and that is to write or speak your history, or it'll be written or spoken for you.
That's right.
And that gets me towards Multani. Mm-hmm. And so if you could share just a little bit of what that means to you, and what does Multani mean?
So Multani, the word, means in Arabic, my homeland. It's a question, and I think we've all probably been, I was thinking about this before, but in particular during the course of this project, what that means. For our Arab American community, who have many of whom have been either exiled from their homelands or left for various factors and, you know, found ourselves all in this community here, what does that really mean to live somewhere when you've come from somewhere else? Where is home? You know, I've explored it. I've thought about that more and more since moving here to San Luis Obispo, but also being involved in this project, right? It's just, where is home? What does that mean to us? I don't know if Vicky and Iyad have different, ways of thinking about that concept.
Yeah, what about you, Vicky?
For me, it's a huge luxury that I can think of home as wherever I am. And I'm aware that that's a luxury for me. I'm aware of it because I'm immersed in a community of people for whom that mostly isn't true. They have had to make this home. And sometimes San Luis Obispo has not been a friendly place to make your home. In my own family, several people have had unpleasant encounters or bigoted reactions from people when their ethnicity surfaces one way or another. And I also have noticed that where I used to live in Southern California, it was extremely popular for not only the Arab American community, but for allies and supporters to regularly wear, for example, a keffiyeh, just out and about, not for any particular reason. And here, people seem to feel a little shy about it. And it can only change if we continue to normalize things like that. This is simply a mode of ethnic dress. It doesn't have an intention behind it. It's an identity. Mm-hmm. And no one should be afraid of another person's identity. I think that's an important message.
I agree completely. How about you, Iyad? What are your takes?
Yeah, kind of building off Vicky's point, I think for me, my homeland has always been Palestine, but that was never always true. Growing up, like, I was very distant from my own identity as a Palestinian. I understood at a very young age through subliminal messaging from society that my identity was inherently political, as Vicky was saying, that anything I would do would warrant any backlash from community, especially I saw this in my schools growing up and just society as a whole. So I always tended to distance myself from it. But it wasn't until my high school, like senior year, that I started to really like think about my own identity and I started to take pride in it. And I really started to like, this is something that we talked about at the panel at our opening event, which I'm sure we'll get more into later. But something that one of the panelists brought up was home as like an imaginary kind of sense. And I think that's what it is for me as a Palestinian in the diaspora, since I've never been to Palestine, never been to Gaza, where my father is from. I've never really had the chance to experience that. So it's always been something that I've had to really imagine. And that's something that is true for a lot of Palestinians in diaspora, and I would say Arabs in diaspora more broadly. I know for a lot of participants in the Multini project, they have a similar experience, but it really does depend on whether they're diaspora or whether they were born and raised there and then later moved. So once again, homeland really does mean different things for each Arab, and I think that's what this project does a great job of capturing.
I think your responses all capture the complexity of what homeland means to people. And in a way, that imagined sense that you're talking about makes me think about, like, home is where the heart is. Mm-hmm. In a way, I know it's not exactly that simple when it comes to something like Multini.
Well, it was very much one of the main questions we wanted to convey or to capture, right? The full title of our project is Multini, Arab American Narratives of Home and Belonging. And we wanted to really question or interrogate that. What does home mean? What does it mean to belong to a place when your parents or your grandparents or your great-grandparents came from somewhere else? What does it mean to belong to multiple places? The one thing we really discovered in all of this is that no one has one place that they call home or even one definition of what home is. And that was really the beautiful thing, to see all those different meanings of home. It was usually the last question we kind of asked during the interview is, what is home to you? And that it was really wonderful to see the different ways in which people conceptualized home, both as a place and as an idea, as Iyad was saying, the imaginary.
And what do we want our listeners to take away from, like, as anticipating attending an exhibit, what would you have our listeners be open to, Vicky?
I think the best answer to that is what we have seen already. Watching non-Arab Americans go through the installation, I kept hearing remarks like, my grandmother had one of those too. Our family went that same route from our home country. I kept hearing these comments. And that shows me that these stories are all the same. You start out at one place, that has become dear to you, whether you've seen it or not, just like what Iyad said, whether you've been there or not, you've smelled the air there somehow. Your feet have felt the soil somehow. And you can relate to anyone else whose feet have felt other soil. You know that in your heart. No one has to teach it to you.
I'm Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. As we continue Central Coast Voices, our guests today are Dr. Farah Al-Nakib, Multini Project Participant, Vicky Tamush, Multini Project Participant, and Iyad Jamali, Multini Project Participant. Multini is an oral history and archiving project that preserves recorded interviews, artifacts, and digital storytelling. You can explore the archive and find out more at www.multinislo.org. This work provides an opportunity to better understand the diverse and multi-generational experiences of Arab American communities on the Central Coast. I wanted to start off with Iyad today and this segment and ask, what are the core goals of Multini?
Thank you. I'd say the core goals of Multini, as we've sort of related to, is to really capture the experience of Arab Americans here in SLO and to understand that their experiences are different, to understand that they come from different places, different homelands, and they have different experiences. Something that Farah was mentioning was usually the last question that we would ask is, what is home to you? And I always felt it was interesting because after talking about your life for on average like 1 hour, 2 hours, and then you're hit with the question, what is home to you? It really does allow them to reflect because of what they told in their interviews. I think if you just ask them that right off the bat, you might get a different answer. But after really exploring the complexities of their stories and their origins, you get a different answer, which I thought was very impactful. And also, another goal of the project was to really allow Arab Americans to speak for themselves. We've never had that chance, and oral history, as Farah was saying, is a great opportunity for that because it's not restricted to solely Arab American scholars, or you have to get a PhD, a master's, or even a high school diploma. Like, if anyone is able to tell their stories, but no one has given us the opportunity. So I think that's another great goal that we've accomplished in this project, is giving the mic to Arab Americans and allowing them to speak freely without, as Vicky was saying earlier, without any traps or sort of, oh, gotcha moments, you know, really trying to just understand their story. And once again, there's no inherent political, ideological thing that we're trying to push behind it. It's really just to capture their stories. Yeah.
I understand. That's amazing. And Farah, what about the launch event? Where I know it happened on the 24th. I wasn't made aware of it until I heard of the Multini SLO project. But if you could share with us, like, how was the launch event and did the community receive it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm excited to share about that. So we launched this first, what I think of is really the first collection of our oral history collection. We have 14 interviews so far, extended. We have more than 35 hours of audio of from these materials with our 14 narrators. So we launched with what we're actually calling an installation at the Cal Poly Library. We're trying to avoid the use of the term exhibition just because of it has for Arabs and other colonized peoples in particular, you know, this experience of having your people, your culture be put on exhibit in European and North American contexts, where it creates that division or divide between us and them, right? Those exhibitions historically were meant to create that distinction and put people on display to be gawked at. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is sort of challenge or decolonize that idea and bring people into these stories in a way, as Vicky was describing, to create those connections, that this isn't about separating our community and making us distinct or apart from the rest of SLO, but that we're part of this community. And so the idea was it was meant to be interactive. It's a space in the gallery that is still on display till March 20th. We curated certain themes, the whole collection into, for now we've got 4 main themes that are also on our website. And we had QR codes where you can scan audio clips to listen to our different narrators speaking on these different themes. So we have about 10 or 12 clips per theme on our website. So you can go through, scan the QR code, listen. We also collected objects of affection from our narrators. So objects that have meaning to them. And again, that was part of the idea of challenging historical ideas of museums where objects were stolen from our part of the world and put on display, completely separated from the context in which they hold meaning. Here, these objects were deeply integrated with the narrator's stories and the narratives they shared in their oral history. And so those are also on display as part of the installation. On the launch event, we also had two members of Rhizome Theater based here in San Luis Obispo, Kyle Berlin and Margaret, I didn't know her last name, but they did a wonderful, wonderful verbatim theater using direct quotes from our collection. And that was just a teaser, 15 minutes. We'll talk about next, what's coming next, I think, later on. I'm sure I'm leaving things out if Vicky and Iyad want to jump in.
Yeah, Vicky, you were sharing some comments earlier about what comments people were saying while they were going through the exhibit. Do you have any other reflections about the launch event?
It exceeded anything I could possibly have imagined. I credit our team with that. I think something that impressed me was such a tiny little detail, and I'm surprised I'm so impressed by this, but the library allowed us to affix certain things to the wall, and I don't mean a frame or a board. It was stuck to the wall as a decal. Quotes and our logo. Our Molteni logo has a very beautiful and deep meaning that I hope you will let Farah explain at some point. And the fact that these were actually affixed to the wall denoted to me belonging. When I walked in and saw that, it wasn't something that could be removed. It was on the building. It was the building. It was the wall. And I kept walking and looking from different angles because it was so important to me seeing that this was part of the building now. Our quotes, our logo, the colors we so carefully chose, all of these intentional decisions were made permanent. And that had a tremendous impact on me. I have never seen that before in any Arab American project. And it really went to my core to see that.
That's heartwarming my heart. Just that sort of integrative feeling of that not only is it a performative acceptance or belonging, but that there is like an intention there.
Yes.
Did you want to explain the website?
There is a good explanation of our logo on the website. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll direct people there. Mm-hmm. It is consists of the Arabic letter M, Mim, for the M in Arabic, and then there's also the English M in between. It's a very complex design, and under our About Molteni section, you can see our identity section that explains that. So listeners hopefully can go to that. And the colors. I wanted to just jump in with one more thing. We had over 200 people approximately who attended that launch event, which we were not anticipating or expecting that many. And they stayed for almost the whole time. It was 3 hours. And that was really, that sent a lot, meant so much to us that our community here in San Luis Obispo, the wider community, came and really spent that time with us.
What went into the labor of, you know, the narrators, the questions, the just sort of like what, how do you go from inviting someone or them expressing their interest to becoming a narrator with a finished story?
So, and I should mention both Iyad and Vicky are narrators, so I think they'll also be able to speak about that from their perspective as narrators. They were also both interviewers on the project. Once we've reached out to somebody and we've explained the project and what it entails and they've agreed to be interviewed, really it's a matter of setting up the time to go sit and meet with them. Usually you want at least a 2-3 hours, you know, space so that you can do, many of our interviews were multiple sessions where you go back, You know, we record everything with good quality recording equipment. And it's really, we as a team came up with a general list of themes, topics we wanted to make sure we covered. We avoid going in with a preset of written questions because we want the interview to go in directions that we could have never anticipated. You don't need to worry about sticking to a strict chronology because people's memories don't work that way. We want people to remember the way that they want to remember and tell their story. So we go in with a loose set of topics, which we all knew the goals of the project very well. And then it's just a beautiful conversation. It's such an incredible process. You get to know that person so intimately and so well. And then after the interview is over, then it's the long process of transcribing and editing and indexing and we're still in that process of working on all of that.
Right. And there was 14 interviews, correct?
So far, yeah.
So far. For folks that might be interested in sharing their story, is there a way to still get connected to share that to Iyad?
Yeah. As we talked about as a team, this project is ongoing. This is something that we hope to continue, where we hope to continue to interview Arab Americans here in SLO. So I'm sure we have a contact on our website where people can contact if they're interested in getting involved in the project in any way, shape, or form. Once again, this is a process where it does require labor, and if we want to continue this, we do hope that people will be interested in getting involved in any way.
Thank you. And I'll just direct our listeners there. If you go to Motani and the website, motanislo.org, and go to contact and the tabs, under the get in touch, there's a choose a form type option. You're going to choose share your story and fill out the required information and press submit. And that way you'll get connected to the team to become a narrator and part of a collection. And
can I add one little thing that we also did at the installation, which we thought, and we are hoping to keep doing this. We wanted to give our community, the wider community, the feeling of what it meant to be a narrator. And so we had a little recording room and we had one of our interviewers in there. And so people could sign up and go in and do their own mini 10. They didn't have to be Arab American, anyone. 10 to 15 minute mini interview, still exploring some of the themes that we did in our project. We have those. We're working on those. We're going to hopefully put those together and share them on our website too. But we're hoping we'll still do that at different events so people will still have the chance to know what it's like to be interviewed.
That's really cool that there's this sort of invitational feeling to the exhibit, whereas, and you were explaining before, Farah, like in terms of Western exhibits, it's to display the person as a, like, more of a phenomenon and less of an inclusive experience. I really get that with the way that you've been describing it. And so when we return from a short break, we'll be talking about the project's intention around home and belonging and how those themes rose to the surface. We're going to take a short break and hear from our team, and we'll be right back on Central Coast Voices.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices on Public Radio KCBX. It's 128. Stay with us for the rest of the show, and then at 2 o'clock this afternoon, Latino USA comes your way. This is listeners-supported Public Radio KCBX.
Hey, I'm Flora Lichtman. Join us every Friday afternoon from 1 to 2 on KCBX for Science Friday. Listen each week for an hour of science news and wonder, where we take a deep dive into big ideas with top scientists around the world. You will hear the latest science news and conversations that remind you just how much fun it is to learn something new. Please come explore with us on Science Friday every Friday afternoon from 1 to 2 here on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio.
KCBX has the soundtrack for your Saturday, starting at 12 noon with The Broken Spoke. It's 3 hours of mostly acoustic, handmade music, indie, folk, Americana, bluegrass, and more. Old favorites, plus lots of new releases and local music, too. My name's Janelle, and I'd love it if you'd hang out with me Saturdays from noon to 3 on KCBX, part of a great lineup of music programming Saturday afternoon and evening. Listen on your radio or streaming online or on demand at kcbx.org.
Welcome back, everybody, to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Dr. Mario Espinosa-Kulig, and our guests today with me are Dr. Farah Al-Naqib, Motini Project Participant, as well as Vicky Tamush, Motini Project Participant, and Iyad Jamali, Motini Project Participant. We were talking a lot about what Motini is, its core goals, how it emphasizes home and belonging in a way that really brings in the audience of folks that are going through these exhibit. One thing we didn't talk about was the panel that Iyad was on. And so I wanted to give an opportunity for you to share with our listeners just a little bit more about what was talked about on that panel.
Yeah, thank you, Mario. So as we sort of touched on, one of the goals of the project was to really place the Arab American community within the broader discourse around minorities here in SLO. And that was kind of the intention behind the panel, is we really wanted to get voices from other minority communities here in SLO so that we can place our story and our experience along with other minority groups in SLO. And the reason there's like a lot of historical context that goes into this, for a large majority of the Arab American experience, we have been considered white, and therefore we have been considered a sort of an invisible minority where we have been included within the white race, so therefore we wouldn't be included with other groups, minority groups. So one of the goals of this project and the goals of the panel specifically was to really place us within that broader discourse and with other racial minorities here in SLO. And there was a lot of different topics that we covered in the panel, such as what is home and belonging, so we could really draw those parallels between different communities and with the Arab American experience. Also, we talked about how SLO treated each minority community and how that really affected their experience here in SLO, whether they felt that home or sense of belonging. So there's a lot of different things that we covered, but those were the main points that really connected to the Multini.
Yeah, and for folks that may not have been there, can you share just a little bit of like what the common experiences might have been, or was there anything that really impacted the audience that was said at the panel?
Yeah, to speak a little bit about what was the common experience, I think it's fair to say that a lot of minority communities talked about how they had to really struggle to really feel like they were included, and they had to really make space for themselves. And that's something that was talked a lot about within the Arab American experience and our oral histories as well. And this is something, this project really represents that, is us like making space for ourselves, because that space was not there. There was a lot of stories about how when people first came to SLO, they saw different racial signifiers that really like put their race on display as something like a very racialized character of a person rather than a person themselves. So it really took the time. They really took the time to represent themselves. And I think this is an extension of that with the Arab American community.
That's awesome. I mean, the commonalities, I think, are more strong than, what am I trying to say? Like, if we focus too much on the difference, we lose sight as to how much more we have in common. And I just say that for most of our listeners, because we are currently experiencing a climate in this country that is giving out sentiments of exclusion, even surveillance and intense backlash for standing up and speaking about Arab American issues. I mean, to the point where we have decision makers asking, or not asking, but implying that some of these intentions are too quote unquote one-sided when it comes to talking about Arab American experiences in this country. And I just respectfully disagree with those types of comments, because it's not fair to give the light of day to everyone who has a cookie cutter experience of what it means to be an American. And I think it invalidates the idea that we as a country are not just a monolith, but we are stronger in the way that we carry our diversity and these experiences. So I just wanted to say that out loud because I feel like there's been such tension when it comes to talking about Arab American issues.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask for your experience, Fada, about what your perspective is as a historian on how Arab American communities have been represented.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that picks up even on what you were just talking about. I mean, that was also one of the goals of our project was, you know, the way that Arabs and Arab Americans by extension have been historically represented in this country has really been based on very negative stereotypes. And our popular culture, our media perpetuate those images, those stereotypes, for decades. This is not just something new. And those stereotypes of, you know, violent terrorists or rich oil sheikhs or oppressed women, all of those tropes that you see repeated again and again really do not express or articulate the actual lived experiences of millions of people who identify as Arab and Arab, also as an Arab American, mm-hmm. Whether in this country, but also Arabs around the world. And that was part of our goal, is to shed light on what are the just real lived experiences and perspectives of Arabs in our community here in SLO, who are, again, not usually given that platform, as Iyad was saying, to speak for themselves. Arabs are spoken about a lot on the media, in other places, but rarely are given the chance to speak for ourselves. And when we do speak for ourselves, you see that the lived experiences, the perspectives are really different from the stereotypes that you see in public discourse, in political discourse, in the media, in TV and film, and so I think that was one of our goals here, was to challenge and upend those stereotypes and really just show how people actually live, which is not that different from the way everyone else just lives,
right?
You know,
I got that from how you described the exhibit was set up, is not only to express these ideas of homeland through the Multinu Project, but also for folks to experience what these ideas of homeland are. Vicky, I wanted to turn to you and ask you about, before the show, I had been talking about how we have continued to see reported spikes around anti-Arab and anti-Muslim bias complaints. And so I just wanted to ask what your experience was in terms of documenting or advocating for people who have continued to experience this sort of discrimination.
I started out in the late 70s working with, at the time there were two Arab American organizations that documented hate crime statistics and assisted victims of hate crimes, Arab American victims of hate crime. And that grew into a completely different entity where eventually Arab Americans were included in the statistics everybody else was gathering, police departments and governmental agencies. And to this day, that's still part of the battle. Before I moved to this area about 4 years ago, I contacted San Luis Obispo Police Department and also the county sheriff and asked if they needed any referrals for good trainers who could talk about, Arab American culture and then also the issue of hate crime. And I asked, when do you release your hate crime statistics? Is it in April like other counties and cities around the nation? And then there's that 30-second silence while they try to figure out a good way to answer me and get rid of me.
Right.
And, I realized right away, okay, we're back, 20, 30 years now in San Luis Obispo. And I have to recognize that and work within that. And, of course, work to change it. But even going back to when I began doing this work in the late 70s and early 80s, law enforcement was not ready for any of this. They didn't want to recognize Arab Americans either, So we documented hate crimes under my name. We made an informal arrangement, and pretty soon I had 500 hate crimes where I was listed as the victim, so that the actual victim wouldn't have to have their name made public. There's, of course, as there is with other ethnic groups, there's the issue of shame when you are victimized, and then the privacy issues that come with getting victim assistance. It could be needing to have your garage door repainted, or it could be that you and your kids now need intense counseling and everything in between. And once I started to see this body of evidence growing, and I had boxes and boxes of files, because nothing was on the computer in those days, of these hate crime reports all under my name, and I was constantly having to file court papers or go work with different law enforcement agencies from cities up to the federal level to try to prosecute these crimes, it became very clear we can't continue like this as a community. We won't survive. And then came the work of educating law enforcement. It was certainly an uphill battle, and I was one tiny little ant in a universe of people doing this work. It was painful. It was often extremely ugly because you were seeing law enforcement, unfortunately, at their worst, where they were resisting enforcing the same law for this ethnic group that they were enforcing comfortably for everybody else. And man, was that hard to watch.
Wow.
It was so painful.
And is that, did you say that was happening here locally?
All over California.
All over California.
And, you know, a few of us just, we happened to be in a line of work where we were learning investigative skills and how to document hate crime for other ethnic groups. And so we made ourselves available to the Arab American community and tried to do as much training as we could. I did so much law enforcement training, I stopped counting after 500 workshops. Wow. And so I probably have done over 1,000 by now, but it's not a badge of courage and it's not an accomplishment to have done it. It had to be done. If you saw a child get hit on their bicycle out in the street, you wouldn't say, I'm not a professional child bicycle rescuer. You would risk your life to do that. And that's what we did, all of us, not just me. All of us.
And I'm interested to hear about what that looks like on a college campus, if there's, like, you know, any recourse, or if there's at least the mechanisms that invite or encourage students to be honest about their experiences and report hate crimes.
Yeah, something. So just to give a little bit of background, I was Muslim Student Association president for 2 years, my sophomore and junior year, and now I'm currently co-president of Students for Justice in Palestine at Cal Poly. So I do have a lot of experience with students and reporting of hate crimes, specifically when I was president of the Muslim Student Association, particularly after October 7th, there was a rise of anti-Arab and anti-Muslim hate crimes around the nation. And of course, I worried that the same would happen here in SLO, and which it did to a lot of our members. And that's something that we would talk about a lot in our general meetings. And I would advise people to report the hate crimes that happened to them, whether it was on campus or in the city of SLO. And a lot of feedback I got was, well, what's going to change? What's even going to happen? What happens if I do report my story? Is anything going to even happen? Is anything going to change? And this is rooted in a history where we have been neglected and our stories and our experiences have been pushed to the side. And the same is true here in SLO, in the university campus, and in the city of SLO. And that's something that I experienced firsthand. And I honestly didn't know what to tell them, because they were right. Because if something, whether it was at Cal Poly or in other areas of California, I felt the same way. I thought, okay, even if I do say something, what's going to change? What's going to happen? You know, and that's something that we're still struggling with. And that's something that is something that we continue to move forward with.
And Farah, from your perspective in working with the Multani mm-hmm. Project, when we think about oral history as a social justice mechanism, what are the aspirations or hope that this project could combat or change for folks?
Well, I think it's exactly that, right? Just knowing the experiences that people in our community go through, right, documenting in a way where they're telling their own story and believing those stories, you know? And so that really, you know, the ability to free people to share those negative experiences that they've had as well as positive experiences, and then to look at that and say, well, how do we work more towards enhancing those positive experiences and reducing those negative? But that's the whole idea, is that we wanted people to tell their own stories and what they've experienced, and for our wider community to listen to those. And that's the thing about oral history. It's not just about, you know, storytelling or telling your story. It's about being heard and other people listening to what you have to say, and you telling it in your own words. And as Iyad was saying, you know, people might not feel safe or even just kind of feel useless, and what's the point of reporting things? But when you're able to tell your story, and not just of one incident where that story might define you, right? As Vicky was saying, you know, as a victim, you might not want to share that because then that becomes who you are. But you can tell your whole life experience and your life story and how things have looked over different periods where different places you've lived. Then those stories become contextualized, and we're hoping that when people listen to them that way, they also realize that these people who are experiencing these forms of racism or you know, other you know, forms of discrimination are whole people with whole stories and families and life experiences.
I'm Dr. Mario Espinosa-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio station. If you recently joined us for today's Central Coast Voices and want to listen to the entire broadcast, you can. It'll be available on our website at www.kcbx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you'll find this show and many others to choose from. You can also find this episode and all our past shows by searching Central Coast Voices wherever you get your podcasts. Just to let you know, a physical exhibit of the Multini Project is available at Robert E. Kennedy Library on the California Polytechnic State University SLO campus until March 20th. Returning with me in the studio today, we have Dr. Farah Al-Naqib, Multini Project participant, and Vicky Tamush, Multini Project participant, and Iyad Jamali, Multini Project participant. We were just talking about the risks of anti-Muslim and anti-Arab bias and the realities of discrimination both on and off of college campuses. I think one thing that was lingering for me was, are there any risks of being visible right now, including through an archive like the one that you're creating? I will start with Vicky.
That's a risk that we take and continually assess every minute of every day of our lives. And when we first started talking about where we would hold the launch and have the installation up for that long period of time, we didn't even have to vocalize it. All of us were thinking, well, what about vandalism? Where is it going to be secure? What are we going to be when someone shows up with spray cans and destroys it or tries to? What about theft? That was at top of mind for all of us. We didn't have the luxury of just planning it where it was most appropriate. We had to think about that too. We think about that in every single aspect of our lives. It determines where we park in a parking lot and where we live and how we get from our car to our house. It determines how we send our kids to school. Are they going to take the bus or are we going to wind up driving them? It's everything. It permeates your entire life, not because we're paranoid and fearful, but because we have learned through experience that the world can be hostile, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like if there is a risk, it's one that is one that the community is willing to take for these stories to exist in that space.
We have no choice. Mm-hmm. We can't survive as people unless there is a certain percentage of us who are going to take those risks. And there have been many times when I have happily accepted those risks because I understood I was in a better position to do so. And I'm not saying that that was unusual or brave or great for me to do. I was standing in a sea of thousands of other people who did the exact same thing and took on those risks because they knew they were in a better position to do so than some others. And yet, others are still going to be victimized one way or another. It's the way hostility works, unfortunately.
ears then. All
right. Yeah, I would like to also jump in on this question that you mentioned as an archive, right? And I think that that's a really important question because one of the approaches that we've taken to this project as really a community-based project is where we, as you know, the project leads, participants, and so on, we work very closely with our narrators. Our narrators aren't just people that are involved in giving their interview and then they sort of disappear from the project. They're very involved. They retain the ownership and the rights, the copyright to their interview. It's never signed off to any archive. It's not signed off to us as Multini, which again is some of those practices in oral history that, you know, are different from old methods, right, where you'd normally sign off your interview to an archive or to an institution. We absolutely did not want to do that. And the narrators have been involved in every step of the project. We've tried to include them. We've talked to them. They've been involved. They've been involved in decision making. When we, you know, any little thing that we would want to do, we would ask their views and opinions. And so in that sense, we're rooting our project in an ethics of care that centers the priorities of our narrators and our wider community before any intended goal of the project or our intentions as project leads, right? And so that, I think, is one of the ways in which we want to see this as a community archive, not just something that the community itself is involved in producing on their terms, not on any institution's terms or any scholar's terms or anything like that.
That's amazing. That's just the work that this world needs, and especially for communities that are aiming to be empowered or to be an owner of their own power, that I think research institutions have not done the best job of doing in the past. So just listening to how much thought is going into the creation of the Multini Project and the care and thoughtfulness of the stories, of the narrator stories, is inspiring to me, because that's such a, like, a stereotype in terms of research, is that typically research institutions, they come into a community, right, and they come out.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And they take.
That's next, right. Yeah. And so that's all I could ever ask for or anyone could ever ask for, is to be the owner of their own story. I want to know if there are any upcoming events related to the Multini Project beside the exhibit. Yeah.
Do you want me to jump in? Yes. Just because I don't know. So we've got a couple of things coming up. We have a few things. Well, first of all, as I mentioned, the installation will be up till March 20th. We do have another event planned for April as Arab American Heritage Month. The installation will be moving out of Cal Poly to the San Luis Obispo Public Library. It'll be a slightly smaller version just because of the space, but the main themes will be up there. We will also have, as I mentioned, a longer version. Rhizome Theater is working on a longer version of the Verbatim Theater, which is absolutely outstanding. We will be publicizing. If people want to join our mailing list to get more information on that, they can go to our website. Also, and our website, we haven't yet put all of the raw material, all of the full interviews yet on our website, because we're being very careful about transcribing and editing those. We're working with an amazing local firm, Arab-owned, called Illuminate. Eight is the number eight, Illuminate Labs. They have been an absolutely phenomenal, they're a web development firm here based out of Santa Maria. They're Arab-owned. Their team have been incredible in building us a very beautiful custom-built website that will house our full archive. So that hopefully will launch in March. That's also something to look out for.
That's awesome. And what about for folks that are aiming and planning to go to the exhibit? For someone who might be overwhelmed, what would you tell them before they come to the exhibit and listen to the interviews?
I think it's important to go there understanding that the best experience you could have would be to listen first. And as you start to hear some of these stories, even if you just listen to little bits of them, and then you see these objects that were clearly very, very important to people and have stayed in the family through generations and have been very carefully preserved regardless of their condition, you start to feel the meaning of these objects come through and how they relate to the person's story. And all of a sudden, you discover the connections with your own story. And that's really what we wanted in the first place.
Yeah. I should also mention that listening to a whole oral history collection can be overwhelming. As I mentioned, we have over 35 hours of audio. But what we've done to make it more manageable to invite people in is, as I mentioned, we have these themes that we developed, that we listened, and Iyad is one of the students who worked a lot on this, as well as our student Nora Sayesh at Cal Poly, who worked on this as well, listened to all of the interviews and extracted some common themes. And we narrowed it down to four for the installation. We're going to keep working on more. And the idea is we excerpted clips from all of the different narrators that spoke on those themes. So it's kind of like a curated tour through the collection. And that's on the walls at the installation. As I mentioned, you can scan the QR codes. The walls have more than just those themes, but those themes are also on our website. And so that's a way to make the process less overwhelming. As a way in, we do hope in the future that people will listen to everything in the whole collections. And people can also suggest themes that we might have missed that we didn't see.
For folks that are gonna hopefully put these stories in a way that might serve some goals of their own organizations or their own community members, how do you imagine folks like educators, students, and maybe community groups will use these testimonies? Yep.
Yeah. Something that we, as someone who has listened to all the interviews, there's a lot of great material that people can use and really draw from to really highlight the experience and the stories of Arab Americans here. Like something that I've been thinking about a lot is one of our narrators was talking about how he was racialized as an Iranian during the Iranian hostage crisis in 1979. And that's just one of so many different stories that educators can use to show that historically Arabs have been kind of under this monolith, right? Whether you're Iranian, whether you're Arab, whether you're Palestinian, Syrian, Lebanese, we all have like similar experiences, and we've all been distinguished as this group, the Middle East, as it is now commonly referred to as. So I think there's a lot to draw from. There's a lot of positive experiences. There's a lot of community organizing, which is something that has been extremely absent, I'd say, in a lot of fields, even in ethnic studies. As an ethnic studies student, I never learned about how Arabs organized in the past to really draw attention to their community and the issues that they're facing. So that's just some of many ways that this collection can be used for educators, for even families, Arab American families, to show that this is who we are, this is our history, and to really emphasize the need to preserve our own histories and stories.
And we just have about two more minutes before we got to get out of here. So I wanted to open it up to our guests just to share just any last words you have for our listeners. And we'll start with Vicky.
Because being listened to has become so important for our community, I want to thank you, Mario, for listening, for asking such beautiful questions, and thank your listeners for listening.
Thank you, Vicky. Amparo?
Yeah, I would like to say, please come out and see the installation, visit our website, stay tuned to things that are coming. This is a very exciting project. We're really proud of the work that everyone has put into it. And so, yeah, I'm hoping that, and if you're interested in supporting the ongoing work, there is a donations link on our website too. Now that our grant cycle is over, we are looking at different ways of fundraising. So,
what about you, Iyad?
Yeah, the only thing I can really hope for is people take the time to listen to the narrators. This speaks for themselves. There's no kind of description needed to contextualize it. The narrators do it greatly. So yeah.
Wonderful. And for our listeners, that is maltinislow.org. And catch me next time on Central Coast Voices on Thursday, January 15th at 1 p.m. with our host, Fred Monroe, and his guests from 100 Plus Women Who Care. Today, our guests were Dr. Farah Al-Nakib, Maltini Project Participant, Vicky Tamush, Maltini Project Participant, and Iyad Jamali, Maltini Project Participant. Thanks for joining us.